CropFM Ausgabe Nummer 366. Wir schreiben den 3. Februar 2016. CropFM geht sozusagen in die 2017, Entschuldigung. Wir gehen in die 17. Season. 17 Jahre CropFM. Mein Gast heute Abend ist Mark Pilkington. Und es geht um Mirage Man und Euphoria. Und auch heute gibt es wieder den CropCom, jenen Live-Chat, mit dem man sich live am Gespräch beteiligen kann. Erreichbar über die Website von CropFM, cropfm.at, einfach einsteigen, Fragen reintippen und bei Bedarf, das Interview ist natürlich in Englisch, aber bei Bedarf werde ich natürlich auch die Skype-Leitung am Ende freischalten und man kann Mark Pilkington direkt Fragen stellen. cropfm.at. Dieser Sendung gibt es einen Newsletter, den kann man gratis beziehen von der Website, so wie alles von CropFM. Man kann mir sehr gerne mailen an cropfm@mur.at. Bitte nicht böse sein, wenn die Antwort lange dauert. Wenn gar nichts kommt, dann vielleicht noch einmal schicken. Das Ganze erscheint als Podcast. Es gibt ein Archiv mit MP3-Downloads. Dort kann man auch einzelne Sendungen direkt verlinken, was mich natürlich sehr freut. Ein Forum gibt es auch, betreut von Unarmed und Wingman. Könnt mir vorstellen, dass zu dieser Sendung dann einige Diskussionen stattfinden. Das Coverbild ist wie einmal gestaltet von Matthias Töpfer und das ist echt, es trifft die Sache schon ziemlich gruselig eigentlich. Mehr von seiner Kunst auf bilderdämmerung.de und wer diesem freien Radioprojekt hier eine kleine Spende zukommen lassen möchte, das freut mich natürlich und wird natürlich auch gebraucht. Geht über PayPal oder als Überweisung, flattern kann man mir auch. Und der Spendenbutton findet sich ganz am Anfang der Seite, das Ei mit dem rosa-roten Herzen. Und an dieser Stelle großes Danke an alle, die ihn schon verwendet haben. Astrophysiker Hinweise, dass das Universum ein Hologramm ist, und zwar erschienen auf Grenzwissenschaft aktuell. Die Wissenschaftler beschreiben eine Möglichkeit, nach der kurz nach dem Urknall das heutige Universum aus einer zweidimensionalen Grenze heraus in drei und vielleicht mehr Dimensionen projiziert wurde, sich danach aber fortan dreidimensional geometrisch weiterentwickelt hat. Die Autoren der Studie sagen damit also nicht, dass wir heute noch in einem Hologramm leben, so wie es Hollywood-Filme wie die Matrix-Reihe thematisieren, obwohl das ist eigentlich nicht so ein sehr Hologramm, sondern eher eine Bewusstseinsprojektion, egal, und unser Universum somit nicht real wäre, sondern nur eine mit Computerprogrammen vergleichbare Illusion sei. Aber jedenfalls schon interessant die Meldung, auch wenn sie natürlich jetzt keine Bestätigung dafür ist, dass das Ganze hier draußen nicht real ist, aber dann, was ist schon real? Musik. Der Host von Crop FM heißt übrigens fetznetz.it, habe ich vergessen anzusagen. Fetznetz.it, der Host von Crop FM. Und wir basteln gerade an einem Update zum Server. Es kommt dann eine schnellere Maschine, die dann noch mehr Hörer verkraftet und so weiter und. Schluss mit Verschwörungstheorien. Russen planen eigene Mondspurensuche. Auf Sputnik News kam das raus. Eine Gruppe russischer Ingenieure und Weltraumfans will aus eigener Kraft einen Satelliten entwickeln und zum Mond schicken. Das ambitionierte Vorhaben soll mit den Verschwörungstheorien über bisherige Mondlandungen Schluss machen. Interessant, dass das ausgerechnet Russen machen. Das Projekt soll Verschwörungstheorien ein Ende setzen, die behaupten, dass einige, wenn nicht alle bisherigen Mondlandungen aus den 60ern und frühen 70ern, also bemannten, gefaked waren. Deshalb soll ein Mikrosatellit in die Mondumlaufbahn gebracht werden, um von dort aus Fußabdrücke und Mondmobil zu fotografieren, die bei vorherigen Mondmissionen auf der Oberfläche des Erdtrabanten hinterlassen wurden. Aber ich bin mir sicher, auch wenn es ihnen gelingt, da gibt es dann genug, die sagen, nein, auch diese Aufnahme ist fake, weil, warum auch immer. Und alle besprochenen Newsartikel finden sich auf der Website von CropFM, cropfm.at. Und hier geht's weiter gleich mit Mark Pilkington, ein Interview, auf das ich mich wirklich freue, eine großartige Doku, ein großartiges Buch. Ich finde, jeder, der sich mit dem Thema UFOs beschäftigt, muss sich auch mit dieser Seite beschäftigen. Und ja, freue mich sehr, Mark Pilkington über die Mirage Man und Euphoria, jetzt gleich auf Crop FM. Mark Pilkington has written for The Guardian, Fortune Times, Sights and Sound, The Wire, Freeze, The Anomalist, and a host of other magazines and journals. His first book, Far Out 101, Strange Tales from Science's Outer Edge, was published in 2007. Mark also runs Strange Attractor Press, editing and publishing its occasional journal, organizing events and exhibitions, and broadcasting on Resonance FM, which is a free radio project in London. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Tarek.
Great, you're on my show.
It's a pleasure.
I have I have finally got around to see your documentary Mirage Man, then immediately ordered the book, and it just blew my mind. It's a great piece of work. It's at last something new, something refreshing in this field that was chasing its own tail for a couple of decades. I mean, in the documentary, of course, you talk mostly about the Benevitz affair, but in the book you go much deeper.
For sure, yeah.
Now, okay, there's one question we have to get out of the way right away, and mm-hmm. that is, are you MI6?
some people would once have told you that I was, but it was certainly a rumor doing the rounds kind of while we were researching and working on the film and the book. But no, I wish I would be earning a lot more money if I was working for MI6.
Oh, boy, yeah.
But in seriousness, that rumor was I think the reason that rumor was circulated that John Lundberg and I were MI6 was to discourage American intelligence personnel from speaking to us, because it's actually a crime to speak to foreign intelligence agents without permission, essentially.
Isn't that interesting? Well,
yeah, that's one take on it. But there are also plenty of researchers who concocted absurd conspiracy theories around us.
And I'm sure there were plenty. But the thing, of course, is if you were MI6, you wouldn't tell. And if you're not, then you just might.
Yes, that's true.
So it's an invitation to hoax. You know, it's on the platter. Yeah, yeah. So, and it's a dangerous question, but I had to ask. Anyway, I've also been accused of being a CIA agent. I have no idea why. Yeah.
And it's a badge of honor in this field.
Yeah, and I agreed to you with you. You would earn a lot of money. And, yeah, anyway. You were also head of the Norfolk UFO Society at the end of the 90s, yeah?
In the early 90s, actually.
Yeah. Oh, early 90s, okay. 95?
Yeah. Or? About 95, yeah, 1995, so mid-90s.
Ah, so I thought 97, but okay.
No,
I wasn't sure.
And that lasted for maybe less than a year, really. I don't think being head of a UFO society was my calling in life, really.
Yeah, but why did it end so soon?
Because I left Norwich, actually. I'd been at university in the city of Norwich in Norfolk, and I was moving to London, so it was quite hard. But they actually, I think they asked me to leave as well. I think I didn't have enough answers. I had too many questions and not enough answers.
Yeah, that's what you write in your book. You were actually approaching the whole subject with an open mind, yeah?
Absolutely. And, you know, at the time, it was very early days in this country for the internet, so there wasn't, you know, the proliferation of material there was now. So I would do presentations on different subjects every couple of weeks. And but, you know, usually, as is only right, they would always end with more questions than answers. But the members of the group, they, you know, wanted answers. And they were it was actually a really interesting experience, and you know, I liked the people, and it was quite a different time. It was around there. There were quite a few genuine sightings of unusual aircraft and, you know, odd lights and things. So it was very instructive in, you know, in the myths of perception, I suppose, is one way you could see it. But a classic, I think. Misguidedly, I put my telephone number on sort of posters around the city, saying, if you see something strange, you know, here's my number. And I'd usually end up saying to people, well, if the light in the sky you're seeing tonight is still there this time tomorrow night, don't call me back. And no one ever did. So usually it's people looking up and seeing, you know, Sirius or Venus for the first time, and seeing, or you know, bright planetary objects or astronomical objects.
Okay,
and a bit startled by them.
So the old cliche, but apparently in some occasions it's just what it is.
It's
a planet, or it's Sirius, or or something like that.
We did have one or two genuine puzzles. We had some flying triangle reports that were interesting. Tales of odd balls of light. I think there was probably early Chinese lantern flights in the area, I would suggest.
Okay. I mean, talking about Venus, I'm sure you know the series UFOs Over Europe, I think it was called. Do you know this documentary series?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Because there was astronomist in this series, and you see a guy who describes an object which is about 20 meters above his head, I think without sound, you know, the usual close-up UFO. And then the guy comes up, the astronomist, and says, well, I think it was probably Venus. So, right. I mean, it was a bit stretched, this kind of explanations at times. But then again, sometimes it is Venus, period.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm very, on a personal level, I'm extremely cautious about dismissing people's experiences. You know, whatever people seeing, their experiences can be very powerful and, you know, life-changing, and it's the actual source of the experience is less important than the experience itself in many cases. So, you know, you can separate the actual phenomenon that they're witnessing from the impact that it makes on them as an individual. So just seeing a Chinese lantern could change somebody's life in a strange and interesting way.
That's right, yeah. It almost did for me. It almost did it for me when I saw my first one.
Really?
Yeah. I was like, what's that?
Yeah.
But, you know, you find out soon enough. And
sure. Yeah. And that's the joy. And, you know, one of the things I love about this field is it forces you to explore and to learn new things. You know, and to learn about science, astronomy, aviation, history, psychology, parapsychology. All sorts of interesting things you learn about.
It's very interdisciplinary.
Exactly.
This is one of the most challenging fields of investigation, in my opinion. Because
I think so.
And you always have to be careful, because whenever you want to laugh off something, you know, it just might have happened exactly that way, and it was just one of those unexplained ones. And you had sightings yourself, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. And so that was instrumental in my understanding of, you know, what it's like for other people. Although the sort of most spectacular, if that's the word, one that I had with two friends in Yosemite National Park in the U.S. in the United States. That was around 1995. It was summer of 1995. It wasn't a dramatic experience for us, but we couldn't. And I still can't identify what we saw. So three silver metallic spheres flying one at a time over our heads. But, you know, at the time we weren't screaming or jumping around or panicking. We were just going, what's that? They're very strange. But the punchline, which I think I talk about in the book, was that I was actually reading a very far out UFO book called Into the Fringe by a woman called Carla Turner, and central to that are sightings of big metallic spheres, which she's told by extraterrestrials are harvesting and recycling alien souls in human bodies. So I was reading this at the same time as three of us saw these spheres pass over us. So that was, to me, was a good, nice kind of intersection of objective reality and internal strangeness. So
you dedicate the book to John Alvar Keel, whom you call an author, adventurer, and two-fisted trickster. Now, first of all, what the heck is a two-fisted trickster?
Well, two-fisted tales was a kind of genre. It was a kind of 1950s, 60s sort of genre of very kind of male adventure writing.
Ah, okay.
And he was kind of, his book Jadu is a sort of classic in that genre, I would say. So adventuring and kind of, you know, men getting into, men exploring the world and getting into scrapes. Fight, he wasn't fighting his way out, but he was an explorer. And Trickster, I mean, there's no question at all that he enjoyed, he enjoyed the game of weaving, you know, great stories out of disparate events. So I think he would, you know, he's unfortunately died some years ago, but he, you know, he would be the first to advise someone not to take some, you know, his books like The Mothman Prophecies too literally. I think storytelling came before kind of factual reporting for him. I'm all for that. You know, I think within the field of Fortean and kind of, you know, paranormal writing, I think there's very much room for a space that's, you know, that's somewhere between fact and fiction. And I think a lot of that kind of writing sits within that space. Not to say Mirage Men is as factual as I could possibly make it. And then in the, 6 years since the book came out, there are a few things I've discovered that are incorrect. But, I didn't willingly lie about anything in there. But I think others, there's a very fine line between deceiving others and deceiving yourself as well. I think that's important. And that's so crucial to the Mirage Men story and Rick Doty's story, I think. A great example would be someone like Whitley Strieber, for example, who was actually the author of Communion, who was friends with John Keel, and I think they recognized this kind of space that's somewhere between the imaginal and the and the phenomenal. How you kind of make sense of that space and relay it to others is where you get into sort of interesting philosophical conundrums, I think. There's some great, actually one of the best contemporary writers on Fortean phenomena, Jeffrey Kripal. That's something he talks about a lot.
Oh, I'm just reading Mutants and Mystics. And
that's a great book, isn't it?
Oh, my amazing. God. Yeah, I'm not through with it. It is another eye-opener.
Yes. Yeah. No, he's a brilliant guy. And a lot of what he's talking about is, again, that kind of bleed between personal and kind of collective myth and reality. And he wrote another great book called Authors of the Impossible, which takes... I think 5 Fortean authors, including John Keel, and sort of talks about them within the context of kind of comparative religion and philosophy, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I always get distracted with other stuff I need to read, I'm planning a show on this whole subject of pop culture and this high strangeness. I mean, that's also what I try to do with Crop FM. It's a little bit of a mixture of these things. But actually, Kripal showed me what I am doing here. Actually, I understand myself better now.
That's great. You should invite him onto the show.
Yes, I will definitely try to do that, and I hope he'll agree to at least hop on for a little bit. And yeah,
I was lucky enough to spend some time with him in London, and he's very, very interested in the whole UFO kind of mythology and lore.
Oh, you can tell. Yeah. UFOs are almost on the cover of his book. I mean, they're in the inlay. Mm-hmm. But yeah. You know, it's. And I thought when I, because I read your book, well, it's already some time ago, but I'm thinking a lot about your book when I'm reading Mutants and Mystics, I have to say.
Oh,
there, there is kind of an overlap there, which is significant in my opinion.
I hadn't read his books when I wrote that. I wish I had, actually, because I'd probably foregrounded those kind of overlaps more significantly, I think. But he's definitely, I think, I'd say he's the most important thinker in this field these days, I think.
I would say he's certainly one of the most important ones, yeah. Yeah. And he's very, I don't know if there are many others who really tackle those subjects that he does in Mutants and Mystics in this way. So I've never read anything like that, so I don't know. But I'm maybe just I'm just starting to maybe get into that stuff. The documentary and the book, they are kind of this is a big hole. So it's a whole. So it's a hole that you also fall into as well. But they kind of go together, and the DVD also has extras. And I have to say, the extras are almost as good as the film. Actual documentary must have been an awfully difficult job to do the final cut here.
It was very difficult, and we were lucky. I mean, the saga of the making of the film is worthy of a film in itself, because the film very nearly wasn't finished, and it was only through coincidence, really, and good fortune on our part that we met Roland Denning and Kip Kiprianu, who assembled the footage that John Lundberg and I had shot into the film that you see. So really, they are as much directors and co-makers of the film as John and I. And a lot of that decision making we left to them, because it was good to have an external, pair of brains, of minds at work on it. Otherwise, because we were just so deep inside by that time.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, so they did a really good job of kind of extracting extraneous material that was really interesting, but wasn't necessarily, didn't help the sort of story flow or the narrative flow. So we made a really big conscious point to just keep it really tightly focused on Benowitz and Doty. But yeah, there's some great, there's a lot of great interview material on that other disc.
Oh yeah,
So that was a conscious decision to do that. And it was the same with the book. I mean, there was a huge amount of material that I wanted, I wrote and wanted to go in the book, but just felt this was too much of a diversion or a digression. It's kind of, you've got to try and stay focused on the story.
And of course there are some really interesting people that are actually just on the extras, like John Alexander. I think he doesn't he doesn't show up in the
not in the film, no. not in the kind of edit, no.
And we'll get to that later. Have you heard that allegedly there are still some UK UFO files that have not been published, and they were dragging along, as I'm sure you know, or you probably know, with publishing those last remaining UK UFO files, and allegedly they should come out in spring. Have you heard about this? Is there?
I haven't actually. I mean, I'm very friendly with David Clark, who has almost single-handedly got all those files released from the National Archives, and from what I'm aware, he thinks he's got everything out. So I don't know, but I haven't been following the story, so I don't know if there are new ones. But I think he had everything pretty much up to date with the last release, which I think was last year.
Okay. When was that last year?
Maybe last year or the year before. I'm not totally sure. But there's all sorts, there's some really interesting tidbits that have emerged from those files. But generally, they always tell the same story, which is that, the whichever arm of the government or the Royal Air Force or whoever, the military, who are trying to make sense of the UFO story are ultimately as much in the dark as the rest of us. Nobody really has any answers. One of my favorite things I remember seeing was a clipping, which was an issue of the American magazine Popular Mechanics from the early 1990s, and it was a speculative well, sort of informed piece of informed speculation about what the latest secret aircraft were, and there was the fabled kind of Aurora black triangle type aircraft. And within the classified UFO files, there was this clipping from National Geographic with a circle drawn around the artist's impression of Aurora, of this aircraft, with a kind of arrow next to it, which just goes to show that, you know, however deep inside the government or the Royal Air Force you are, you're still stuck reading the same magazines trying to get answers. Because they were, at the time they were getting reports of strange aircraft seen over Scotland and off the Norfolk coast as well, and were trying to understand what they were. So all they could do was read Popular Mechanics articles. So they didn't have any deeper insight or knowledge than any of the rest of us.
All right. Let's go back a little bit. I mean, the whole Euphoria lore, it started, let's say, I mean, in the late 40s or something like that. I mean, there is this ominous year of 1947, the first integrated circuit, the first hydrogen bomb that was tested. The CIA was founded, the National Security Act, the first flight of an airplane faster than sound, and Roswell. I mean, what the frack happened? I mean, this is, what a year.
I think it's the year, it's basically the year that the Cold War began, essentially. I think that's what's going on. It's just a year of, it was probably the first, the beginnings of the kind of, it was the real beginning of the end of World War II, when the dust was finally settling and the new era was starting to begin. So, you know, a lot of the technologies that had been evolved in World War II were starting to kind of enter into civilian kind of kind of culture. A lot of the organizations like the CIA were starting to get formalized. It was just a year of coalescence, I think, especially in America and between America and the Soviet Union, which was that was really the beginning of their kind of Cold War. But I think the Roswell crash is important, but it was less important then and probably now than Kenneth Arnold's sighting of nine fast flying objects over Mount Rainier in Washington State. That's that's the event that really started the UFO as we know it.
And coined the term, yeah.
Jones coined the term flying saucer, and UFOs came a bit later, about early 1950s. But and that's really what begins the story. And what's what's interesting, if you do read, say, Jeffrey Kripal's books, is you see that actually the areas that these things were taking place have always been hotbeds for kind of mystical experience and sightings. So it's, they're really just part of a continuum of unexplained events that were then sort of imprinted with a new technological face, in this new technological age. The really interesting thing for me about Kenneth Arnold's story is that when he first started talking about what he'd seen, there was very little discussion of them being extraterrestrial in origin. The discussion was all about them either being secret American aircraft or secret Soviet aircraft. And it was only later that the idea of them being from outer space kind of emerged, when the Air Force tried to kind of put a lid on speculation, really, about secret American aircraft. So, that's really where the origins of the UFO mythology aren't really in outer space. They're in, they're in the black budget even then.
Yeah. And then a year later, we have The Flying Saucer, a book by Bernard Newman, that and the plot of the book is I haven't read it, but I read about it in your book. But it's incredible. It's a fake alien invasion to bring global unity. Now, haven't we heard that a lot recently? I mean, Stephen Greer. he talks about something like this. I don't know if you followed him recently or if you followed him at all. But
I've in the past, but not recently. I haven't.
Yeah, he's adamant about we are running into the danger of being presented with a fake alien invasion to, you know, coerce us into submission to whatever. I mean, and
to the new world order.
To new world order. And,
yeah.
And this is actually from the 40s, and so many things. I mean, in general, that's one theme of our discussion today. Is you mentioned Jeffrey Kripal. I mean, a lot of the stories and tales, and even things that then later came out in secret documents that were leaked, they were actually reflecting, or they were actually plots that you could read decades before that in sci-fi or in sci-fi mm-hmm. literature.
Absolutely. And it just shows, I think what that demonstrates really are the kind of limits of our imagination about, you know, what aliens are going to be like and what outer, you know, what our experience of outer space is going to be like. But the, so in the flying saucer, there are uncanny similarities to the Roswell story, so the important thing to kind of recognize about the Roswell crash, which has taken on such a kind of profound, almost religious importance within the UFO kind of lore, is that at the time that it happened, it was a news story for one day, and then after that, nobody spoke about it again for nearly 40 years. It was no one was interested. The flying saucer, you know, reflected on what that might have been, and yeah, as you say, presented it as one of many kind of fake alien spacecraft crashes. And the other part set up by a group of scientists wanting to promote world peace. But the other amazing thing about it is they promote world peace by giving every nation on the planet, even the smallest nations, they give them nuclear weapons so that everybody is on the same kind of plateau when it comes to kind of military development. Mm. So that's not something that would be considered
a sound
healthy
idea
in this day and age. I'm just trying to think of other. What's also great is he was inspired by a speech made by the British. Bernard Newman, the author, was inspired. The plot for the novel was inspired by a speech by Anthony Eden, who was the British Foreign Secretary at the time, who said at a United Nations conference on the 1st of March 1947, so 3 or 4 months before, 3 months before the Roswell crash, he said, "Sometimes I think the people of this distracted planet will never really get together until they find someone on Mars to get mad against."
Mm.
So, and you know, if you think of the timing of that statement to the United Nations, and then the kind of development of the kind of UFO craze that kind of began, four and a half months after that, it's quite interesting that that was obviously an idea that was in the air, kind of within the sort of geopolitical sphere at the time.
And Reagan made a similar statement 40 years later.
Absolutely. Yeah, he did in the early 80s, exactly, mm-hmm. talking about that that was what was, you know, a threat from outer space is what was needed to bring about the end of the Cold War, basically.
Yeah. And he would be right, probably. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, you'd think, it's hard to say. I don't know if you saw the film The Arrival that came out last year.
No, but I'm going to this weekend, probably.
Yeah, it's an interesting film, and that's one of the uh-huh. questions that it raises. Yeah, it's a refreshing approach to the whole alien contact kind of theme.
Oh, good. Oh, then I will definitely watch it. And then there is this other side. So there are those authors like Bernard Newman, who quite early on already brought this subject of deception and how this whole subject that just spurred off quite a craze in the 40s and, of course, in the 50s, the Washington sightings, how this could be used. And the other side were channelings and spiritual people who were in spiritual contact with entities, beings, and very much influenced by theosophy.
Yeah.
Which is also very interesting, which is also overlooked completely most of the times today. So we think that this is all new, but no, it first appeared in the midst of the 19th century.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's people don't really discuss the fact that, you know, the earliest days of the kind of, you know, UFO culture, there was a very much, you know, there were two strands really. One was the sort of spiritualist strand, and the other was the sort of engineering and technology strand, and they were very much, they were coming at the story from two very different angles. But as you say, the sort of spiritualist and channeling strand was drawing upon traditions that had been around for almost a century by that time. And then you get, so from that you get groups. The most famous group in sort of England and America were the Aetherius Society, headed by George King, who was a private chauffeur in London, who sort of began to channel messages from Mars and from Jesus, actually, on Mars, I think he was.
From Jesus on Mars?
Yeah, I think he was on Mars. He may have been in on Venus, I can't remember now, but I think he was on Mars. But he then, that was very much the style. You would open up your mind to transmissions from they were kind of spiritual radio transmissions, really, and then you'd kind of transcribe the information that you received from them. There were quite a few groups doing this. There's a famous kind of sort of New Age commune up in Scotland near Loch Ness called the Fintorn Community, and they began as a channeling flying saucer kind of group who were expecting extraterrestrials to land in the area, but they've now sort of transformed into quite a respectable kind of New Age organization. They don't really talk about the flying saucer origins of the group anymore. But so I think in my sort of one of the sort of themes I look at in Mirage Men is the idea that you had basically the spiritualists and the scientists in the early days of the UFO lore, and the scientists were looking at technology, hardware, astronomy, and were probably, a lot of them were actually people working within, people, for example, there was at White Sands Missile Testing Range in New Mexico, there were a group of scientists investigating UFO sightings in the area, which I suspect was getting a bit too close to the truth around there, because they were flying all sorts of new rockets and aircraft in the area. And then you had the more kind of spiritual side, and I think there was the emergence of the contactees, people like George Adamski and Howard Menger and George Van Tassel and Orfeo Angelucci, these kinds of characters, they were coming much more from the kind of spiritual side of things, and they were given more emphasis, I think, partly because their stories were more colourful and made better news stories, but also it helped to create a kind of cloud of absurdity around the UFO subject that made it easier for it to be dismissed by the Air Force and other military and government agencies. So if they wanted to discourage the nuts and bolts scientists from looking too closely at what was going on and encourage the more fantastical stories.
There was this UFO occupant that talked to a Herbert Schirmer in 1967, and he said, "We want you to believe in us, but not too much."
Yeah,
and that's perfect. I mean,
that's one of my favorite. I have two favorite kind of exchanges between sort of extraterrestrials and humans. That's one of them, and the other is offhand can't remember where it happened, but the extraterrestrial asks the human what time it is, and the human looks at his watch, tells him the time, and the alien goes, "You lie," and tells him the correct time. they're just such absurd encounters that have a lot of kind of surrealist humor and play in them, that they feel like they're coming from a dream or from the imagination.
And I'm sure you heard about this encounter that Jacques Vallée also lists in his book Passport to Magonia, where this UFO lands in the garden of the guy, I think in France, sometimes in the 50s, and he asks for oatmeal and water, and then he...
Oh, yes.
I mean, what?
That's actually in Kentucky. That was
Kentucky, okay.
In America, yeah. I can't remember the name offhand of the contactee, but they make pancakes, basically.
Pancakes, yeah.
Yeah, and they were dressed as they were human looking and dressed. There's a nice detail. They have quite well fitted dark colored trousers with a red stripe running up the side of them. So they're in a kind of nice sort of smart uniform. All of the flying saucer occupants.
And the inside of the saucer looks like a kitchen.
Yeah. I mean, they kind of lower a barbecue or something, I think, and cook the pancakes. Another nice detail of that case is that one of the pancakes was analyzed by the U.S. Air Force via Alan Hynek, the kind of astronomer who was heading the American UFO investigation at that time. And it was found to contain no salt, and Jacques Vallée makes the astute observation that fairies and kind of denizens of the fairy kingdom could be dispelled with salt, so they didn't want any salt in their food.
And see, that's one of the parallels where I really have to say, well, I mean, this is so... how should I say? What are the odds, you know? Because also oatmeal, I think, is used by the fairies.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. What is going on here?
I firmly, you know, it's a very Fortean line, but I firmly take the line proposed by Jacques Vallée, John Keel, you know, and Charles Fort and others that, you know, they're just part of a continuum of otherworld encounters with, you know, with intelligences that may or may not be from somewhere else, or they may just be sort of shards of our own consciousness or our collective consciousness that we, you know, some people encounter in these very odd moments, which I think, you know, are very profound, and they're often humorous and surreal and quite meaningful for people, I think. And it's a shame, you know, I think it's a shame when these experiences become kind of filtered and constrained and shaped by, you know, the desires of an individual or a time period. So you get in the 1990s, you got this kind of very confrontational approach to these encounters, suggesting they were all about foreign aliens coming here to steal our eggs and DNA. You know, it was a very it was a very kind of combative approach. And one that filtered out many of the interesting aspects of these encounters in order to create a narrative that kind of fit a more straightforward American sort of B-movie paradigm.
But that's also why they didn't want you as head of the New Fork anymore, because you wouldn't jump onto the story. You said,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, and that was actually the peak. That was the kind of peak time for the alien abduction mythology, really, which has doesn't really happen anymore. But at that time, it was really it was what that was kind of considered to be a kind of invasion, really.
Yeah, and I mean, I understand why it felt like that. I mean, I interviewed people, and I'm convinced that they lived through something that was shocking and so on. But we just don't know what it was. And it could be an alien, but what's an alien? So yeah, it's.
No, I agree. As I was saying earlier, would never dismiss someone's experience out of hand. They obviously had an experience that was important to them and had an impact, but. I would never, you wouldn't. I think describing it as an alien abduction is actually diminishing its magic and its importance. You know, it's trying to make to
probably,
It's a reductive approach rather than a kind of helpful and constructive and therapeutic approach.
Yeah, and someone corrected me in the chat. I said oakmeal, but it's oatmeal. Yeah,
oatmeal. Yes,
oatmeal. Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. Oatmeal.
Oatmeal. Yeah.
So, why do you think that this whole euphoria thing, and I love this phrase, but I think you don't, it's actually the title of a film from the 80s, Euphoria, yeah?
A terrible English comedy.
About UFOs.
About UFOs featuring one of the... it's a terrible thing to say, but one of the worst English comedians of the late 20th century, a guy called Rory Chubby Brown.
Okay,
there's no reason for anyone to know too much about, but it was the name of the film. Yeah,
and it's a great, really a great, the word and the title is great, so it's Euphoria. And why do you think that it cropped up in this post-war environment? Why then?
Meaning the human race, were at that time really starting to think more seriously about outer space and to think about, really starting to think about going to outer space. And, you have the first satellites, Sputnik launches in 1956 and Telstar, the British satellite. It was the beginning of the space age, so we were imagining, I think we were kind of projecting ourselves into outer space and imagining that the flying saucers and the UFOs were in some ways just ourselves visiting other planets. And, certainly through the 40s and 50s, most of the occupants described in UFO encounters are essentially human, certainly humanoid, but to all intents and purposes are largely indistinguishable from humans. So we weren't really thinking that hard. I think it's just, as with so many things, it's us projecting ourselves out into the cosmos. I think there was also a great hope that, we'd done by this time, after World War II and before that World War I, and then, Vietnam and countless other kind of ongoing battles, we were doing a terrible job of keeping the planet in one piece, really, of keeping our kind of species and culture together. So I think there was also a real hope that somebody, a wise version of us, angelic versions of us, would actually descend in these incredibly advanced, almost magical technological craft and save us from ourselves. And of course, if you see the 1951, so much earlier than early in 56, Robert Wise's film The Day the Earth Stood Still has exactly that happen. A kind of interstellar policeman called Klaatu, who's a kind of almost a Jesus-like figure, descends with his alien, his robot kind of policeman Gort, and they basically tell us not to destroy ourselves with atomic bombs, or else they'll destroy the entire planet for us. And that was what the world wanted—a kind of
someone to tell them what to do and what not to do.
Exactly, a strong
man.
Leader.
Okay, yeah. We just got rid of our strong man.
Yeah, but also in many at that time, I think America also saw itself in that role in the world. You know, it had the atomic capability, so it wanted to. It saw itself as Klaatu, as the atomic policeman.
Yeah, so ufology, sci-fi literature, Harry Warmer's sci-fi literature, even, and pop culture. Obviously, that's a very, very interesting and explosive mixture. And most or a lot of the themes first appeared in sci-fi literature, as we already said, like Oscar Binder's Mankind, Child of the Stars, that you also mentioned. And it makes you think. I mean, and now let's go a little bit towards the documentary film. Richard Doty shows Linda this document that we were bred by aliens, and this story that since then has just spinned around and around and around forever, it seems. And I mean, this story, it could have been inspired by Mankind, Child of the Stars.
Absolutely, yeah. And it may well go back even further than that, but absolutely, it's it's a classic science fiction trope, really, that we are we are ourselves offspring of some extraterrestrial breeding experiment, genetic experiment. It's interesting to wonder where AFOSI, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations that Doty worked for, where they got this idea from. The way they worked was that they were very much canvassing the UFO community, listening very carefully to what the UFO community were talking about, and then recycling that material into their documents to make the documents kind of confirm the beliefs that people already had, to reinforce
their
beliefs.
Very clever and very sinister.
Yeah, and that's the classic. That's how you play disinformation, and we're seeing it all the time now, on almost daily on the news coming from America and elsewhere in Russia. But the story must have been in the air within the UFO community, but had obviously science fiction stories don't come from nowhere. They're ideas that are being discussed, being imagined anyway. If you go back to Charles Fort, even writing in the very early 1910s and 1920s, he has the great suggestion that we are merely property. And that he proposes that we're actually just kind of like cattle. We're some kind of either food or pets bred by some greater extraterrestrial or sort of superhuman beings for their pleasure and entertainment. It was an idea that was out there, but it's ironically becoming more, as is often the case with science fiction, it's becoming more plausible, to the point where we will very soon be able to engineer, we can engineer small life forms, but we'll be able to engineer, entire complex life forms in a few decades' time, I'm sure of it. And may well start sort of firing them into outer space to seed life elsewhere.
Yeah, would make sense.
I'm quite a big proponent of the idea of panspermia, the idea of life around the universe is sort of seeded by genetic material in the heads of held in the heads of comets, which kind of bombards its way onto planetary surfaces and eventually evolves into sort of complex life forms over many millions of years. But the notion that we're extraterrestrial breeding experiments is a version of that jumped ahead several sort of iterations, I suppose.
So you mentioned disinformation earlier. So this is basically fake news and alternative facts, which probably will become the word of the year. And so we are living in an age where this has been developed to perfection. And And we will have to see where it all will lead us, which will be quite fascinating.
And quite frightening, I think.
Yes, well. Quite frightening. Yes, really frightening.
But the internet has made possible what the sort of, you know, disinformation. The fake news idea has been around, you know, since forever, really. You know, but back in the sort of 1940s and 50s and 60s, you had to have, you know, operatives inside newspapers who would plant the stories for you. Whereas now, you don't even need a newspaper. You can just fire it out into the internet, create a fake news site, and circulate it on Facebook. And you know, you've got a revolution. And it's just it's really unstoppable, and it's increasingly difficult, even for people who, you know, experienced readers or researchers. It's increasingly hard to kind of unravel and unpick stories. These ideas, I think this practice was kind of certainly, elements of it were certainly kind of refined through the internet, through the UFO community, I think. So beginning in the 1940s and 50s onwards, but really coming to a head, so I think in the 1980s with the Benowitz story.
Yeah, and let's come to that. Just before that, it's also interesting that Bill Moore and Richard Doty wrote a science fiction novel together, the Aquarius Project. I guess after all this happened, but.
It was during the time as well. It was It was them and Bob Pratt, who was a very respected journalist, actually, but wrote for the National Enquirer, but was highly regarded.
Fascinating. Now, can you give a short description of what happened in this whole Benowitz affair. So the movie, as I said in the beginning, is mostly, or as you said, is mostly concentrating on this Benowitz affair because it is really a great example of what is happening and how this is happening. But something like this happened, a lot of times at different places and different times. Yes. Yeah. Although you don't think that they are connected, that's also an interesting, something we could discuss.
For sure, yeah.
Anyway, so the Benowitz affair. What, for those who haven't heard about it, what happened?
So the sort of action takes place around Albuquerque, which is the capital city of New Mexico, in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And there is one of the sort of key air bases in military air bases in America, Kirtland Air Force Base, which for a long time, until I think even up to the early 1990s, also was a major storage facility for America's nuclear arsenal. So it was a really important, an important military site. And in the late 1970s, a local engineer called Paul Benowitz, who worked, ran his own company, Thunder Scientific, making sort of technological instruments for the Air Force and for NASA and for the Navy. So he was, doing quite serious, very serious work, and was a very, very kind of skilled engineer and scientist. Began seeing strange lights flying over the Air Force base over Kirtland at night. And they were kind of doing strange loop-the-loop type maneuvers and flying in a way that he felt, that human-engineered aircraft couldn't fly. So he reported this to the security chiefs at the base and, as a result, became entangled in a very sort of strange and complex tale of kind of deception and disinformation that unfortunately drove him to insanity, and he ended up in a mental hospital for some while under observation because his mental state deteriorated so badly. But what was happening as a result of this is that he was being fed information by the Air Force to believe that a hostile extraterrestrial invasion was taking place, centered partly around a small Indian reservation about 100 miles away called Dulsi. And he was kind of led to believe there was an extraterrestrial base inside a plateau there from which the invasion was taking place. And he was being fed fake documents by the Air Force, which he was then seeding out into the UFO culture and the community. He was quite vociferous within that community. And just a lot of the ideas that he was fed at that time about extraterrestrial sort of exchanges of technology with the US government, alien abductions in exchange for access to technology, genetic programs, all this sort of thing, eventually became sort of central to the UFO mythology, to the lore, and also many aspects of the Roswell case kind of emerged through this process as well, or were fed into this process. So it became, so what became the kind of core story, that, if you like, of the sort of UFO mythology, and then fed into things like the X-Files, which then made those stories kind of part of international global folklore, really. All can be traced back to this one series of deceptions around Paul Benowitz. And this was not people. There was one, the sort of contact officer for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations was a very young junior officer called Richard Doty, whose job it was to kind of feed the information to Benowitz and then report back to FOSI. He was ultimately exposed for his role in this, but he certainly wasn't the only player, and the sort of chain of command ran all the way back to the Pentagon very clearly. So this wasn't just, people say he was a rogue operator, but he was just part of a bigger operation. And it's quite clear when you sort of follow the chain of events and the chain of command that the operation was actually centered around protecting the stealth program, which at the time was very much at the cutting edge of global Air Force technology, and was being tested in and around the area. So, there were strong suspicions that the Soviets were inserting moles and contacts into the UFO community to try and extract information about the stealth program, because obviously UFO researchers are very interested in new technologies and aviation technologies, and they hang around air bases and photograph what they think are UFOs, which might provide bits of information about these newly emergent aviation technologies. So in a that's not quite a nutshell, but that's essentially the story.
Yeah, well, incredibly complex. I mean, at some point there were different agencies apparently involved with Benowitz, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. Afosi didn't know where he got some of the information from, and there was another agency, some people suspect it was the NSA, mm-hmm. who provided him with a computer that was kind of fitted with some programs that would at the end he was just fed complete gibberish that his mind, that was already far into the rabbit hole, would make sense of in a certain way, and they were beaming information into mm-hmm. his office, and he was measuring that stuff. I mean, it was unbelievable. They went through great lengths to really frack this guy up.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a good point you make, is that as well as the lights in the sky, he was intercepting some kind of transmissions that were coming from the base, which, according to Doty and others, were actually some kind of National Security Agency kind of encryption project. And he, being a brilliant engineer, had found a way to decrypt the signals, which obviously caused them some alarm. So yes, that led them to send him off on another wild goose chase. So yeah, the rumor is, and I don't know if it's true, I don't think it's ever been confirmed, the rumor is that they got Alan Hynek, who was, you know, the most revered man in the UFO, American UFO culture, to hand deliver this computer to Benowitz so that they could feed him extraterrestrial nonsense, basically.
Wow. And one of those, I mean, there are so many details, and I mean, I can only recommend reading your book. You should look at the documentary and then read the book, or maybe the other way around, I don't know. But there's so much more detail there. But one of those really fascinating details is the FBI investigated MJ-12 on behalf of Fozzi. Now, I'm jumping a little bit. Someone who was involved in the Benowitz affair was also Bill Moore. He was also feeding him information. Mm-hmm. Bill Moore was a very respected UFO researcher in the early 80s. He wrote a book, The Roswell Incident, and that apparently raised some eyebrows. And this Richard Doty also approached Bill Moore, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So what they were doing, they identified... I mean, I have a slightly different take on it in the, about Bill Moore's involvement. Some people see Bill Moore as, he was drawn into the disinformation program because he was at that time the most respected and most visible American UFO researcher. So I think my strong suspicion is that the U.S. Air Force had decided to infiltrate the UFO community in order to flush out potential Soviet moles. So they were actually looking for people to do the work for them and to work with them. So they identified Benowitz and they identified Bill Moore. And what they were, Bill Moore was there to add credibility to the fake documents that they were producing, and to keep them up to speed with, you know, with the latest developments in UFO research, and also to investigate other UFO researchers to sort of check whether they might have any affiliations with, you know, with enemy states, or be passing information to enemy states. So the MJ-12 documents, which, if people don't know about, are kind of appeared to be the Holy Grail that revealed the truth about the cover-up of the Roswell crash in 1947, and the setup of a kind of governing body of military and scientific advisors who would manage the sort of investigation and release of information about extraterrestrial contact that was made in 1947. These papers were made up at the Pentagon by people in AFOSI, but very much drawing on information that was given to them by Bill Moore. So I think one of the purposes
they used Bill Moore to find out what people could believe, in which
absolutely
direction their speculation would go, and then they reinforced it by some fake documents, and of course people would swallow it.
Yes, absolutely, and they were, you know, initially, they look very convincing, but over time, people notice very tiny details, things like, you know, the president's Harry Truman's signature looked like an identical version could be found on another document, so it was clearly a sort of stamp or a photocopy. There were certain issues with the way dates were presented that were anachronistic. Yeah, there were tiny little details. Actually, my favorite detail is that the within the alleged 1947 government secret government report about the Roswell crash, they miscalculate the distance from Roswell, the city, to the crash site, and the distance is the same wrong measurement given in Bill Moore's book, which was written, you know, 35 years after these documents were supposed to have been typed out. So that's, yeah, that's a pretty damning piece of evidence, really. Yeah. But the idea, I think the idea with this documentation was that it would be fed into the UFO food chain, partly to trace where it got to and to see who was giving information to who, to try and sort of make sense, to try and draw a kind of join the dots to the Russians, but also just to create so much nonsense and chaff within the UFO field that it made it impossible for anyone to, you know, draw useful information about the new technology, new stealth technologies from it. But yeah, the FBI got involved in an investigation because a young trainee FBI agent actually was found to have a copy of the documents, which say, you know, top secret for president's eyes only, and this, you know, and this led to an investigation as to what they were. And the Air Force initially denied having any knowledge of what they were, and then eventually, anonymously, someone from the Air Force basically sent a letter to the FBI just saying, just best to ignore them. it was something we did, but we don't really want to talk about it. So, and to this day, it's we still don't know exactly how it emerged, only that Bill Moore and Doty and FOSI were all involved. And I don't know, I mean, certainly in the 90s and the early 2000s, the MJ-12 papers were absolutely, again, the core of the UFO myth, but people don't talk about them quite as much anymore.
But they are still out there, and there are still people who are convinced they're genuine, and I mean, they'll just never go away. As all good disinformation, for sure, they also contain some genuine stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's likely that there are nuggets of truth in there. I don't know offhand what they might be, but yeah, there may well be. And for example, there was a group called Majestic 12 or Magic that was involved with some. I think it was to do with bringing foreign scientists into the country, perhaps something along those lines. But it was quite an obscure, obscure organization. But it had a real name, which meant if someone did a massive document search, they'd be led off down another route. And there's a couple of project names listed that also refer to genuine projects that had nothing to do with UFOs. So, you know, there are Project Snowbird, I think, is one of them. So, you know, they were little clues that would send you off into further digressive research and steer you away from whatever it was, you were looking for. So they did a great job of creating a massive wild goose chase for the UFO community for many years and stopped them actually looking for UFOs.
Yeah, and another project that you discuss in The Mirage Man, in the movie, and of course also in the book, is Project Serpo, and someone also mentioned it on the chat here, which is another one of those myths that just won't go away.
Yeah, I'm surprised that hasn't gone away, actually, but it was pretty comprehensively sort of picked apart and analyzed and revealed to be nonsense sort of 10 years ago now, really. But that was emerging, that story was emerging just as we started, as John Lundberg and I started, decided that we wanted to make a film about the Benowitz and Doty affair. And what was remarkable to us was that Doty was, he'd been silent and invisible for 20 years or so, and he suddenly appeared on the internet as if summoned by the Serpo story to disseminate the material that, the Serpo material. which yes, still a mystery as to who wrote that stuff, but there are, you know, there's a lot of it. So someone was working hard to produce those documents.
So it cropped up in a news group sometime
a sort of online email distribution list, so political, mostly a political and sort of new age discussion list. Who originally? There's no question at all that Rick Doty was involved on some level, if only perhaps just in the dissemination of the material. I personally don't think he wrote it, because I don't think he would be able to write it. But someone worked hard on it, and it's unclear who it was or why and what the purpose was. But there's no doubt at all that it's just more disinformation that doesn't relate to anything kind of that actually happened. And it relates, what was clever, as with the best disinformation, it related back to stories that were already circulating in the UFO lore for a long time. One of my favorite things is it plays upon material in the film Close Encounters of the Third Kind, in the final sequence where the Air Force guys enter the alien spacecraft with Richard Dreyfuss. That was also
great
kind
film.
Of
work. Great film, I mean.
Great film, still a great film, yeah. And that was all, that material was worked into the Serpo storyline. So, there were lots of connections to kind of other, to the wider mythology. But that material just kept on coming, and, there were always promises of visual material, of photographs. A photograph I always wanted to see and never did was of the Air Force sort of astronauts playing football with the aliens on planet Serpo, which would have been great.
That would have been something, yeah.
I don't know if it would have been probably American football rather than soccer, but
no. Or foot orb.
Foot orb. I won't go into it now, but in the book and the film, we explain how the information was traced back to Rick Doty through kind of the IP address detective work. Really a puzzle, a real puzzle as to what was going on there. And the concern for John Lomberg and I at the time was that the guy, English guy, who kind of took on the role of disseminating the material, was we didn't want him to kind of lose the plot and become another Paul Benowitz and, go crazy. And he was put under a lot of pressure. He was definitely suffering. And then he went on to start something called Project Camelot, which is, I think, still ongoing and sort of, again, pumping a lot of fairly ludicrous material, some of which is probably disinformation, out into the internet.
So you're talking about, what's his name again, from Project Camelot?
Bill Ryan.
Bill Ryan, so, yeah. I mean, Project Camelot, it's great entertainment. I mean,
it is, yeah, great entertainment. It's hard to know. Again, you see, I haven't watched those interviews for a while. But
yeah, me neither.
You get a sense that there are just so many pockets of people, so many groups of small, quite tightly knit groups of people who are living, the closest comparison I can think of is people who do sort of live action role playing or cosplay and things like that, which I think are great, which I don't do myself, but I'm a fan of. But, people who create these alternate fantastical lives and realities around themselves, which usually position themselves at the center of a bigger mythic narrative, is the kind of unifying factor in a lot of them.
Now, coming back to the more technical side of things, and time is running mm-hmm. fast, why is this all happening?
We can carry on a little bit more.
Okay, that's great, because my list, oh my God, it's so long. Okay. We won't get to anything anyway, all of it anyway. It's interesting. Albuquerque is such an interesting place. I should go there sometime. I mean, Linda Howe lives there. And then... Mm-hmm. Another detail of your book, it's also the place where the Directed Energy Directorate is located. Now, isn't that interesting?
Absolutely. So beam weapons, basically, yeah. Lasers and energy beams, yeah.
Yeah, and there was also some communication with satellites going on that Benevitz stumbled over when he was looking into the Dolce or into this whole thing. And one thing that I really didn't know that. There is this book by Leon Davidson, I think is his name. It's ECM. ECM plus CIA equals UFO.
That's I love that.
The United, that's the... Yeah, the formula of everything of ufology, maybe. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how powerful ECM, which is electronic countermeasurements, how powerful that is. Can you expand a little bit on that?
Yeah. So this is going. Leon Davidson was a White Sun. I think he was a White Sands engineer who got interested in the. So he worked on the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos, that's right, and was so, and then was involved with the Los Alamos UFO group in the late 40s. He was a chemical engineer and fairly important in the Manhattan Project. He took a great interest in the sightings of green fireballs, which were being seen over White Sands in the late 40s. And he basically came to the conclusion fairly quickly through his investigations and talking to other people in the in military circles that these were all rocket and missile tests, but that at the root of the UFO story were experiments with technologies to deceive radar, so to kind of paint the shape of an aircraft onto another aircraft's radar scope, and at the beginning, this would the technology was actually first noticed during World War II in the Pacific when aircraft carriers with really powerful radars got too close to each other. You created what they called galloping ghosts, which were kind of almost like fleets of unknown aircraft flying over the area, and obviously this was potentially hazardous for the Americans to sort of think that there were enemy aircraft coming towards them when there was nothing there, because it would waste resources and time and generate kind of anxieties and things. Anyway, so they tried to kind of focus this technology and develop it further, and that's what they did. And Davidson's great sort of most sort of controversial statement, which I actually am quite persuaded by, was that the famous overflight of UFOs over Washington, D.C. in July 1952 was actually some kind of demonstration of this technology, possibly by the either the CIA or more likely the NSA, the National Security Agency. I won't go into the details now. We'll talk about it in the book, but there's a lot of persuasive evidence about that. And if you look at things the way that case is described by observers at the time and Edward Ruppelt and his sort of classic book from the time, whose name is momentarily escaping me. It just looks like a setup, something that was set up as a demonstration. But the technology was refined over the years. In the 60s, it was given the name Palladium, and it allowed really quite detailed manipulation of aircraft, of radar imagery, so you could create the sense that there was a number of very small aircraft in the area, or one really big aircraft in the area, something flying very fast, something flying very slow. And they would use this to kind of just to trick enemy aircraft or enemy missile silos and things. And it's used, I think it's now used fairly standardly. It was used in Libya in the 1980s. They were going to give Colonel Gaddafi, they were going to frighten him by making him think that there was a massive aircraft invasion happening of his country. And I suspect, if in the book I look at a few famous UFO incidents involving military aircraft, and when you sort of piece these together, it looks like they're basically testing this stuff out on their own pilots, but wanting to maintain the UFO story at the same time, so they don't reveal the technology that they're actually using.
And I mean, there's some of the most compelling evidences that people always bring up is radar evidence. Mm-hmm. So when something is seen in the sky, and I mean, there's Bob Emmenegger talking about 3D holograms that he has seen. Mm-hmm. They seem to be quite proliferate. I mean, Project Bluebeam comes into mind, this rumored mm-hmm. project where... And if you combine that and this incredible radar spoofing technology, well... I mean, that's it. How can you distinguish that?
Yeah,
that's really fascinating. I didn't know that. And that you can also, but you can also cancel out the radar image of the plane and project it ahead of the plane, or mm-hmm, mm-hmm. so, or just cancel it out altogether. But mm-hmm. then the question that comes to mind: you mentioned the stealth fighters that were developed in this time frame of the Benevitz affair, but what mm-hmm. do you need stealth technology for, developed in the 80s, if you could do that in the 50s?
Because the technology wasn't good enough, I think. You know, I presume they were always trying new technologies, but
or you couldn't spoof all the radars, maybe.
I mean, I think uh-huh. if you could develop an aircraft that was completely invisible to radar, that's going to be more reliable than. Yeah, because you still need aircraft to project the ECM radar spoofing technology, don't you? So, yeah, I would imagine that they were fitted with that kind of, the stealth planes would be fitted with that, with those kinds of ECM technologies. I would guess, but mm. you know, I think you're never going to put all your eggs into one basket. You're always going to be trying to develop to new technologies. Maybe they knew that the Soviets knew about the radar spoofing tech and were developing their own. Who knows? If you could develop a plane that they couldn't see on their radars, then they wouldn't have anyone to spoof because they couldn't see your aircraft. Just coming back to technology, the other thing that I found really kind of surprised me as I was doing the research, which I mentioned in the book, was the idea of the silent helicopter, which had always been one of the kind of staples of much of the conspiracy theory literature of the 80s and 90s. And you get lots of accounts in the 70s of mysterious silent helicopters seen over UFO investigations, and actually during the Paul Benowitz's investigations around Dulce, which involved mutilated cattle and things, he saw strange silent helicopters. And I'd always assumed this was an impossibility, but actually doing some research discovered that they were developed for the Vietnam War quite successfully. And then after the war, the technology disappeared into the CIA's kind of jigsaw of companies, and were, you know, no one knows quite where they went, but the CIA were using them for something. So
silent helicopters, so they could hover 100 feet above you and you wouldn't hear it, or maybe not above you, because you would feel the wind.
You see them, but people who experienced them, the test flights in the Vietnam War, said it was a very strange feeling because you could see them, but you could only hear it, what sounded like a distant, very distant, so whining sound. Not at all what you'd expect from a helicopter. So, and certainly you couldn't, you know, you wouldn't have, if you didn't see them coming, they would completely have you by surprise. And they flew them, initially they flew them at night with no lighting, no external lights, and using very low light levels for kind of cathode ray TV displays inside the helicopter, so they could fly completely silently and with no lighting.
And with radar spoofing, so they were just invisible.
Yes, exactly. And actually, interestingly, the mission that killed Osama bin Laden, what, 3-4 years ago? I can't remember how long ago it was. It was the first time they were spoken of in the mainstream media.
Yes,
because
I remember.
One of them crashed, and they found there were photographs of the tail of the tail with the tail rotors, which had been modified for silent flying. So that to me was a big breakthrough. And again, how many UFO, if you accept that they were able to fly silent helicopters by the late 1960s, early 1970s, how many UFO, technological UFO encounters could be explained through that technology. I think to me that was a bit, to me, along with the Leon Davidson story, they were both huge, just massive pieces of the puzzle falling into place.
Yes. There's this Cash Landrum incident that you also bring up, which is really interesting. And I think Myrna Hansen was involved in that, yeah? That was the lady.
She's someone else. She was connected to Kirtland. She was an alleged abductee who got involved with Paul Benowitz and Kirtland Air Force Base. No, the Cash Landrum case was in Texas, but involved two women and their grandson who basically saw a fleet of Chinook helicopters, twin rotor blade helicopters, escorting a strange aircraft that looked like, they described it as a glowing flying diamond, and the diamond sort of descended, according to their account, the diamond descended onto the road and actually burned part of the road and melted the dashboard of their car, and according to their story led to burns on their skin, which led to radiation poisoning. It's a very complex, tricky case, but it's the case that led Rick Doty to basically deceive Linda Moulton Howe, who was investigating the case for a TV program she was commissioned to make. There's a lot of it in the book, but you get a real sense that that was a case that the U.S. Air Force were concerned about being made public at the time.
Was that...
If you think back to this period, it's hard to remember pre-internet. If you could keep an incident like that away from the local press, it would never, ever make it into the wider culture.
Was that the incident that Richard Doty talks about when he says that, because Linda Howe, who I think is a great journalist, and I think she's a very honest journalist, and she was the one who actually broke the cover of Richard Doty, because she was just going public with it, that's Linda Howe. And apparently Richard Doty was quite pissed off with her. And you can even see that in the interview when he tells you, but we then gave her a fake story and she ran with it, so to say.
Yes.
Was the Cash Landrum story this fake story?
I think Cash Landrum happened, and it was because she was investigating that they gave her a false story that kind of distracted her.
I know, Cash Landrum
but I don't think
happened.
I don't think it was Cash Landrum.
Okay.
Cash Landrum happened. I'm pretty confident that Cash Landrum was a genuine story, and that's what she was investigating.
Yeah, no, but I understand it happened, but maybe they gave her some false leads on this. Okay, so that was
that story. Sorry, I don't know. No, I don't know what the... misunderstood you. I don't know what the... what the fake story they gave her was, but
yeah, I was thinking about it.
She reported on a lot of crazy stuff over the years.
Yeah, so because one thing that I thought it could have been that, but that was much later in the 90s. That was this alien drone story that she had.
Oh, that was much later. Yeah, that was that was about 10 years ago, wasn't it? So early 2000s.
Okay, that's
later.
Yeah,
I don't think that was that. That was clearly someone, having a good time with
CGI.
Advanced CGI software, but was great. But yeah, she really, really ran with that one.
Yeah.
She's amazing. And we waited 4 years to get an interview with Linda, and everyone thinks she's the star of the film. really, of Mirage Man.
Oh, yes. And it is, I mean, I interviewed her, I think, 4 times. And she, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it's not really interviews. I mean, you start her and then she just gives an account. Mm-hmm. And this is mm-hmm. just perfect. I mean, it's mm-hmm. you don't even want to interrupt her. You just write down some questions. I mean, she's amazing. And but you could see in this documentary, it's really chilling when she asks you, you know, I'm not going to be in a documentary that says this is all faked and so on. And when she asks you what exactly is your bottom line on the film, I mean, she's really adamant about this, you know. She's mm-hmm. And that is a chilling moment for me. And then there's this other chilling moment, maybe it's in the extras, where you then recapitulate the whole thing and the whole way you see it and with all the figures that you interviewed and just looking at her face, how she, you know, this, I think she's really deep into this whole thing, and they really got to her in a lot of ways.
I think so. I have a lot of respect for Linda, but I think that moment, it sort of simultaneously destroyed her career as a serious journalist and invented a new career for her as within the UFO community. I think that moment, you know, moment when Rick Doty gave her those papers.
Yeah.
You know, she's absolutely a force to be reckoned with. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, wow, yeah. And if she goes after a story, I mean, there's no holding back. She's...
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, okay, there was also a crop circle this year that was faked, and we come on to that that was also faked, I should say, but that was done by a company called Mothership Glass as an advertisement.
All right.
Have you followed on that one?
I haven't actually, but okay. That's something that was happening. That happens quite. That's been happening for a long time. Yeah. Advertised through crop circles.
Firefox even did an advertisement.
Yeah, I worked. I actually worked when I was making crop circles. I worked on a few that were sort of for advertising purposes. But,
mm-hmm.
So that's not a new development.
And I want to get to that, but first quickly. John Alexander, I think, he also comments on the Cash Landrum case, yeah?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he says something really interesting. He says the helicopters that were seen were not really there. Isn't that what he says?
Something like that. So I don't know.
What's that all about?
That I couldn't say. That is quite an enigmatic comment. I'd forgotten that. Yeah, I don't know if he means that they imagined helicopters or whether he's saying some of the helicopters were... You know, is he hinting, perhaps, this has only just crossed my mind now, that the whole thing was some kind of staged demonstration of some projection technology or something? Who knows? It's very hard to know how far a lot of the technologies that are described by people like John Alexander and Bob Emenegger, you know, like holographic projection technologies, which now you see in, you know, Broadway musical performances, you know, where you have Elvis or Frank Sinatra or Tupac Shakur, dead pop stars performing on stage, you know, but
yeah,
back in that's the same technology that's being described, but 30, 40 years later. So I don't know, would it be possible to, you know, project holographic helicopters in front of real helicopters, for example? Who knows?
I don't know.
John Alexander says a lot of cryptic things, you learn. But he's another person I have a great amount of admiration for, and I've had quite a few conversations with him. And I think he felt there were a lot of problems with some of the things I'd said in Mirage Man, and at one point he was going to tell me what they were, but he hasn't, which is a shame. I'd like to have known what they were. But the idea with Mirage Man, really, I don't see it as a... In no way is it a kind of final statement. It's my hope was that it would open this whole field of discussion up into the both into the wider world, but also into the UFO community. And I think, you know, my hope was that people who weren't interested in UFOs would think, well, if this much time and energy was spent you know, creating something as absurd in many ways as the UFO law, then, you know, in what other areas of geopolitical and social reality have these techniques been deployed? And
exactly.
Now, five or 6 years later, we're starting to see it happening big time.
Oh, yes. We're living in Gaga Land.
Exactly. So that was, you know, I think, you know, I feel quite, one of the things I'm so proud of with the book is that we can refer back to it as a kind of history of fake news in some way.
As Linda calls it in the documentary, a hall of mirrors with a quicksand floor.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And that's the problem. I mean, that's the other problem with, you know, the UFO lore is just so huge and so rich now. If you're just getting started on it, you know, you go through so many phases of belief and disbelief and paranoia and suspicion and wonder. You know, it's a very powerful ride, really. And it's really, you know, I think, and I was interested in the material from a teenager, so Mirage Men, in a way, is my kind of presentation of my exploration of over sort of 20 years of reading and research and things. And I hope it, you know, I wanted it to be something that anyone who's getting interested in the subject, you could hand it to them and, you know, give, if they could start from that perspective, with that perspective, it would be much
healthier.
Yeah, healthier,
no,
exactly.
I think it's a great piece of work, and will you do a revised version? You said there were some errors that you found.
Would you
comment on one of those? I mean,
I was quite small stuff. Three things I'd mention. One thing that was some documents that were made available to me literally as the book was printed, so I couldn't insert them, are incredibly important, and I wrote about them at the time. That's up on the Mirage Men website. A document from 1950 that was put together by the RAND Corporation, which was a subsidiary, was a kind of a part of the US Air Force at that time. And it's a document about the exploitation of folklore and superstition in wartime. And it talks about, you know, World War One, World War Two, talks about creating monsters, vampires, fake astrological journals, all sorts of amazing stuff. But nowhere does it mention flying saucers, which is bizarre that it emerged, given that it emerged at the peak time of the most interest in flying saucers in American history at that time, 1950-51, and was produced by the Air Force, who were absolutely admired in the UFO story. So to me, that's a really interesting document. And again, it's basically a kind of historical manual for Mirage Men activities, but outside of the flying saucer circuit. One of the things I would revise, certainly, I would kind of re-present, is the way I talked about the cattle mutilation story. And I think I would spend more time, although I think certain things definitely happened, it's clear that, you know, that was a sort of social panic within the ranching community. I don't think that there was I'm less persuaded that there was some kind of conspiratorial aspect to that.
Okay, that's interesting.
Just again, through talking, I've met some interesting people who know about, you know, the way, for example, you would. So in the book, and we discuss how the cattle mutilations that were happening around Dulce, New Mexico may have been some kind of environmental monitoring program to look at the way that radiation might have leaked into the environment after a atomic weapon was detonated there in the 1960s.
They did some kind of fracking, early fracking,
yes, exactly,
with atomic bombs, which is completely
bollocks.
I mean,
yeah.
It's insane.
Insane.
Yeah, it's just
but
insane.
So I suggest that the cattle mutilations might have been trying to sort of monitor because there were radiation problems in the area, and children were being born with defects and things. So they might have, the animals may have been kind of cut up to look at the way radiation had passed into their systems. But I spoke to a guy who used to work for the CIA, who was a sort of toxicology expert, and he said that's not how you would need the bones rather than the flesh to kind of look for, I think it's strontium-90, to look for the radioactive isotopes you would need. So that's small things like that. And there's a couple of, there's one aircraft, I can't remember now what it's called, there's one aircraft I mentioned from the sort of 1980s or so that I wonder if that was I'm talking about optical stealth developments and optical stealth technology, and there's an aircraft I mentioned that actually the people who built it got in touch after seeing it mentioned online to tell me that it wasn't what I thought it was.
You also mentioned a very fascinating satellite, a low orbit satellite that is basically looks like a silvery sphere. Which is probably responsible for some of the UFO sightings for sure.
I don't doubt it. Yeah, that's the NASA Echo satellite from 1960. Yeah. One of my favorite images relating to the book, actually. This is really,
I've never seen that. Wow. If you see that somewhere.
Yeah. And the scale of it, when you see humans next to it.
It's huge.
They look like ants next to this thing. So there are a few more bits. I would definitely consider revising it maybe, for its 10th anniversary, which won't be long. Being 4 years now, it's a bit shocking.
Time flies.
There are other books I would like to have written that extended the Mirage Men idea away from the sort of, away from the UFO and paranormal field, but I've since become admired in publishing other people's books, so I don't really have the time to do the research at the moment, but I would like to.
Oh, you definitely should take the time. I mean, you do a brilliant job. So, I mean,
thank you.
That would be quite a pity. Now, one of those other strange details is those orange balls of light that even Richard Doty sees in Benavid's home at his ceiling. I mean, orange luminous balls of light. Now, when I read that, of course, immediately I thought about Wiltshire. Now, of course, we come to this subject of crop circles that, of course, you also cover and you just briefly address it in your book. And I mean, there is, and I quote, there is this line that really I found quite fascinating, where you say, yes, people make crop circles. Well, we know that. But then you say all of them. And have done so since the mid-70s. Now, I've been in Wiltshire several times, and I've been in crop circles that were clearly man-made. I've been in others where I just don't know. I've been in crop circles where, well, I have no idea about the psychology behind this, but you get into this circle and you feel different. I mean, you really do. I have no idea how that would work with a hoaxed one. And I've talked to guys like Tony Hughes, and he said that, Tony Hughes, the guy with the...
I don't actually.
He has this ultralight flying center there. So whenever I go there, I always go up with Tony. It's just, it's so beautiful. I mean, and let me say that. I mean, if anyone who does those circles, okay, I mean... These are great artists, no matter where they come from. I mean, I have total admiration for them, and I'm not really too biased on what it actually then is, the source of all of this. But yet, Tony, for example, told me that he was flying in Wiltshire and Salisbury Plains danger areas, and so he had a corridor 15 minutes going in and out, and there was this field, no roads, no people, nothing. And when they come back after 15 minutes, there is this 100-foot crop circle. So was Tony just lying to me, or how?
Do
you do that? How do you do that in 15 minutes?
Just a simple circle on its own.
That's the thing. I listened to an interview I did with him in 2003, and I didn't ask him about it. So
if it was a simple circle, you could probably do that in, yeah, in I think you probably could do that in 15, 20 minutes if you, at a push. My suspicion is, you know, that he had misjudged how long, you know.
He was adamant about that.
Then it's possible that someone could, I think it's not impossible that you could do that in 15 minutes. Also, and I would also wonder whether he might be pulling your leg or generating, you know, the crop circles in Wiltshire accounted for a significant part of Wiltshire's tourist economy, and certainly his, you know, it was I'm sure Tony does well out of that economy, so it helps everyone to keep the magic alive, I would say. So,
well, yeah, but they're also fighting the magic, they're cutting them out, you know, I don't know. It's a mixed picture for me.
It's a mixed picture, but all I would say is that, and I can say this with confidence, more confidence than I can say about almost anything else in the world, is that, you know, any formation with more than one, that's more than just a simple circle, is human-made. I can say that with 100% confidence.
Why any formation that is more than a simple circle? So you mean...
I think possibly, and I think most, almost all simple circles are human-made too, but, you know, when you get... It's not impossible that you could get circular wind damage, for example, that would look circular. But beyond that, nothing. No, everything's human.
So you're 100% sure of that?
Absolutely. 100. Right. If it's possible, do you more than 100% sure, and more than 100%
okay.
sure.
Okay, I talked to Andreas Müller. Do you know Andreas Müller?
No.
He's a German crop circle investigator since decades.
Right.
I mean, and he really is also quite adamant about all of this. And he says he talked to the farmer from the East Field, and the woman tells him that she has seen crop circles in the 50s. So who did those then?
People made them, yeah.
Also in the 50s?
Yeah, there are accounts of... there's some nice stories, actually. You should get a book that... one of the first books I published was called The Field Guide, which if you get... I'll send you a link to it by email, but it just talks about some of this. It's sort of history and philosophy of crop circle making. But in that, there are accounts of how, in the 19th century, accounts of, like, young lovers who would make circles in the fields in which to, you know, have their encounters during the day and night because they can't be seen, for example. So, you know, there are...
That's quite clever, actually. Okay.
And if you're actually in the crop, no one can see you. So there's all sorts of, you know, it's not If you live in the fields or amongst the field and work in the fields, you'd learn very quickly that you can do a lot with them. But you know, the more obviously by the time we're talking about, they've become very complex pieces of art. But as I always say, you know, if you're standing in front of a Guernica by Picasso, do you think this is so beautiful and extraordinarily complex? No human could ever have made this. Of course not. You think, wow, what a great artist Picasso is.
Another thing, I remember this day, I still remember it, as I was really into crop circles in the early noughties, in the early 2000s, and I would get up in the morning, drink my coffee, have a smoke, and look at the crop, at the circle, what's it called, the crop circle connector, and then I see this thing, Milk Hill, in 2001, and I look at it, and it's like, ah, come on, that's Photoshop. I didn't believe it. Then I looked a little bit closer, and hey, it's a really good Photoshop. And then I seen ground shots, and I was really like, oh my god! Were you involved in Milk Hill?
I wasn't, no. But I could have been, but I wasn't.
How it's laid there. I mean, how it's placed into the landscape. This is absolutely breathtaking.
It's huge, that's for sure.
409 circles. I mean, give me a break.
It was a perfectly complex operation, let's say.
Well, yeah.
One little detail is, like, as if you look at one edge of it, you'll see that it almost went a bit wrong and almost goes over the road. So there was a very slight misjudgment on the kind of measurements there, mm-hmm. which and one of the things you get, you know, one of the way, it's an incredible piece of work, and I wish I was part of that one.
Oh yeah,
for practical reasons I couldn't be there, but you know, one thing that happens often with the crop circles is what you often see is not the original formation. You're seeing, you know, you're seeing it kind of perfected and represented in an pen and ink, in an ink form, rather than, you know, in a wheat form. If you see what I mean, you see a representation of the formation, not the formation itself. So if you look at the actual formation itself, once you know what to look for, you can see the very human imperfections in them. And to me, it just makes them all the more exciting that they're made by humans. What an amazing phenomenon in themselves, and the way that they can inspire and transform people's lives, I think, is wonderful.
It was done in one night, in a rainy night.
Mm-hmm.
I had the telephone number of a guy who allegedly camped there. He was a lawyer from London. That's all I knew. I tried to call mm-hmm. him. I didn't reach him. I then forgot about this, and. He said he was there the whole night. There was nothing there. He didn't see anyone. And then he woke up in the morning and he was more or less in the midst of this crop circle. So this guy was part of the gang then.
I don't know that story, but that if he was in another distant part of the field, it's quite, it's a pretty quiet operation. There's no need for much sound, just the sound of crunching. I don't do it anymore, but we didn't use artificial lights, you know, we didn't, there was no technology involved. So
you use night vision goggles or what?
No, just use your eyes. No, nothing.
So these are done when the moon is...
Not necessarily. You just, okay. I mean, you need a little bit of moonlight, ideally, but you would... You would do it. You know, your eyes adjust pretty quickly to darkness. You wouldn't be able to do it in pitch dark night, but you wouldn't need a full moon. Certainly, don't want a full moon because you'd be more visible.
I understand.
As an example, the first one I ever took part in 1997, the team I was with, who had been making circles for about 4 or 5 years by that point. That was the first formation they ever had to abandon because there were people shooting rabbits in the field, and they didn't, you know, we were halfway through making a crop circle and they had torches and guns and they couldn't see us making a crop circle, and we didn't, but we saw them obviously with their torches. So, you know, you can be in the same field as people making a crop circle and not know that they're there.
Okay. And that would also explain why those who go on crop circle watch wouldn't mm-hmm. see that on the east.
No, you wouldn't need to see anything. No.
Okay.
And the fields are big. You know, you could be at one end of a field, and a large formation can be happening at the other end. And there's, there'd be very few signs that anything was going on. Really.
This is so amazing. And
unless you were unlucky, and you know, unless the circle making team accidentally ran into you, or. You know, you ran into them, but generally speaking...
But that seemed to never have happened. I mean, I never heard of any case where someone ran into...
Amazingly, it hasn't, no. I mean, I know the guys I work with, there was one incident once where one of them stumbled into somebody, or nearly stumbled into somebody, but didn't actually, that's right. But very, 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 very nearly did. There was someone sleeping in one of the formations.
Okay. again, Mill Hill. But you need GPS or something like that, wouldn't you?
Nothing at all. Just
how do you do that? How do you measure that so accurately?
15 years ago, you just do it on paper. It was all done you'd use sort of. Things like CAD sort of did, you know, at that time they were using computers to construct the imagery. But, you know, all we had were sheets of paper with the printed imagery on and the measurements, and then ropes, planks of wood, and tape measures, and that's it.
So really there's not even any exotic technology involved. It's just ropes and boards.
Nowadays, I don't know. I mean, it's over 10 years since I was involved, so I'm sure technology has crept into the field. But at that time, no, it was all very simple.
But I mean, lots of people will of course would disagree with you on these points. But okay, that
they will.
Yeah. Now, and there have been people who said, okay, let's do a crop circle and let's see how difficult that is. And mm-hmm. I mean, they did an incredible bad job. So you really have to practice. I mean, these were genius. I mean, you guys are genius. If you really did that, if you did Milk Hill with just ropes and not even high accurate GPS or whatever, this is absolutely genius. I mean,
I didn't do it.
I'm flattened on the floor. if that's the case, I'm
very skilled. But yeah, you have to practice. The other thing to bear in mind is it's very rare for the press or the crop circle community to publicize bad, there are a few really bad formations, and they tend not to get publicized because they undermine the power, they undermine the myth if it looks like an obviously botched job. But the other thing that would happen, say if in the very rare occasions where something went wrong, you would flatten the work. You wouldn't leave a half finished piece of work out there, or you would finish it very quickly the next night. That's happened once or twice, but very rarely.
Yeah. There were accounts on circles that were extended the next day.
Yeah, so that does occasionally happen, but generally if you wouldn't leave something that was obviously a mess out there. You don't want to see your sketches out there. But people have to train, and what's been interesting to me is, it took quite a few years for people to be able to get, you can see the evolution of the complexity. And I mean, I haven't been following it that much of late, but it's interesting to see, the teams I was working with are mostly stopped because they're just a bit old, but there must be younger teams who have started off making quite simple things and are now making more complex formations, and I expect that they are using technology now. It'd be interesting to talk to them about that.
And I mean, allegedly the hoaxers were always hanging out in the barge in, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I've been there.
And again, doing intel work, listening out for what people were talking about, and then using that information to make formations that would blow people's minds, basically.
Yes, you were targeting individuals.
Exactly.
You were using Mirage Man techniques. You were becoming Mirage Man. I mean, Mirage Man.
Yeah. No, I think I know of at least two instances.
You're bad boys.
I know of at least two instances where influential individuals in the crop circle community were essentially targeted to produce so that formations were made that would blow their minds and then set off other events. Certainly that happened.
Michael Flickman wrote a book about a crop circle that he goes on in length in 2008, I think. It's called The Bones of God, and I even did an interview with him. Do you know this crop circle?
No, I wonder which it was. I stopped not long after that. Let me just look it up online.
Yeah, it's really a beautiful one, and he's adamant about the almost impossibility of making some of the features of this thing. So
right, I'm just trying to see.
And he convinced me.
That one, I know that one. That's not. I wasn't involved with that, but that one doesn't. That one echo. Didn't it have some connection to those CGI? Looks a bit like stuff. Those CGI drones that. Or some element of the CGI drones.
But it also encoded Pi and stuff.
Oh
like
yeah,
that. Yeah, yeah.
But people. Again, what's interesting is you'd find researchers would uncover, amazing geometric and mathematical relationships within the formations that sometimes were intentional on the parts of the makers, and just as many times weren't. So they would, you know, they would kind of find meaning within the mathematics that wasn't necessarily intended to be there, but in a lot of cases it was intended to be there. So yeah, okay. Again, it's a game.
Oh boy, it's multi-layered.
Yeah, but I always say, you know, people don't, you know, enjoy the crop circles as art, but don't spend too much time trying to read. You know, well, it's lovely that people, it is inspiring that people read so much magic and meaning into them, but, you know, it's unhealthy if they are looking for non-human sort of origins for the material, I would say.
Well,
they should be humans inspired by other humans rather than humans inspired, and nature, of course, humans inspired by other humans and by nature. But
yeah, my take on it from the beginning was it's an incredible bunch of artists wherever they came from, and they're doing this work without getting any credit for it. You could never, I mean, yeah. How can you do Milk Hill and not brag about it? I don't get it.
That was always part of the code, really. Oh, there was quite a strict code of engagement.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, wow.
But have a look at our book, the field guide. It will open up.
Yes, please, there. Please. Yeah. And then I will go there again, and I will. Yeah, maybe see it with different eyes. Now, before letting you go, I know you wanted to do a 1-hour interview. Thank you very much for extending it.
That's been a pleasure.
There's this Oliver Castle video, okay, that a lot of people thought it's genuine. It was shown in, I don't know, in one of the pubs, maybe the Barge Inn, I don't know, about in the evening of the same day the crop circle appeared, or at least where it was discovered. So and who did this?
I can't tell you who, but I do know who did it, but I can't tell you. Basically, it was a two-part operation. So there was a filmmaker who I don't know, I can't remember his name, I didn't meet him, who shot the time-lapse photography of the crop circle team making their crop circle, and then the balls of light were digitally superimposed later onto the footage, onto the time-lapse footage. So it was a well-planned operation.
Yeah, but the light was the same, you know. So they did, and they photographed this place when the crop circle was not there. Then they did the crop circle, and then they photographed it again, and then they blended it over and put in the light. So that's basically the story. Mm-hmm. But it's brilliantly, I mean, again, if this is made, and if it's brilliantly done. Wow.
Yeah, No particularly advanced Hollywood technology involved. Just
not
kind of people, computers. And that was quite early on for CGI as well.
Yes, I was told people talked to guys in Hollywood and asked them how long it would take them to do that, and they were quite. I mean, they said it would. Yeah, you can do it, but it would take quite a long time, and you need absolutely high end equipment. That's what they told them. So that's bollocks also.
No, that's not true. Yeah.
Okay.
it was a great piece of art, really, a sort of trickster, it blew people's minds.
It blew my mind when I saw it. I mean, I don't know. I always leave those things in the gray box as Steve Bassett, it's fascinating and it's really well done. I mean, I don't know.
I will pass on your it was nothing to do with me, that one, but I'll pass on your admiration.
If this was done by people, then I'm just flattened by how they did it and how they kept silent about it. I would wish that those people would eventually come out, show the proof, you know, show the photographs when you did Milk Hill. I really think that would be a good thing.
I don't think, there wouldn't be photographs, but...
Yeah. Then there will be people who will never... you know that there will be people who will never believe that these are man-made.
For sure, absolutely.
Never.
I have somewhere in a box, I actually have some muddy diagrams that I used to... That were actually used in the formation, so... one day I might.
But you don't have film of you never filmed yourselves doing those crop circles.
No, but there is film from I think New Zealand, I think National Geographic or something, flew members of the team I was in out to film them making a crop circle in the 90s. So you can probably see that online. It was part of a TV program. So,
well, okay. I mean, I'm planning another nice experiment this year. We will do. I'm sure you heard about remote viewing.
So I'm
in touch with some really talented remote viewers. They had some very astonishing results. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And they will remote view crop circles when they were made about in a couple of feet over the 50 feet over the ground, something like that. And
right.
Let's see what they come up with. I hope we don't front load them today with some idea. I'm really curious what they will come up with.
So. Okay, and I think you should read the book, read the field guide as well.
I will certainly do it. Send me the mail.
I'll remind you by email.
Okay, thank you very much.
Brilliant. Okay.
Okay, well, so, baby, last thing to say is the end of your film. I mean, Bob Amenigger's song that mm-hmm. he just invents that in that moment.
On the spot, yeah, just completely on the spot at the moment.
It is wonderful.
He's one of the really most amazing appearances.
I mean, there are a lot of amazing people there. I mean, Linda Howe is there and so on. You mentioned her. But Bob Amenigger, I mean, and this song, I just love it.
Yeah.
Okay, on that note, it was a pleasure to talk to you. I would love to repeat this sometime in the future. Maybe there is something new, if there's maybe the revised version of your book, just give me a nudge.
And I would
love to do it again. And thank you very much for being my guest tonight. Even if you shattered some of the illusions or dreams some might have, or if you just hoaxed us again, who knows that? But it was a funny and interesting discussion, so I really enjoyed it.
Right, and me too. Thank you, Tara.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Crop FM. Glaubt, was ihr wollt.
Ja, so ist es. Vielleicht haben wir jetzt ja das Rätsel der Kornkreise gelöst. Was auch okay ist, ist total okay. Also ich habe natürlich ein Problem damit. Wenn so ist, ist es einfach so. Und dann kann man sich anderen Dingen zuwenden. Ne? Kann man das abhaken und es gibt so viele Dinge da draußen. Und ja, Wahnsinn. Also Landschaftskunst vom Feinsten kann das sein. Das nächste Mal ist Andreas Winter mein Gast und es geht um die sogenannte Palmblatt Bibliothek. Er ist nämlich gerade selbst in Indien, holt sich inzwischen schon sein zweites Reading. Sein erstes war schon ziemlich faszinierend. Offenbar, manchmal kann man da sogar vorhersehen, wann man stirbt. Ich weiß nicht, warum man das dann vorher wissen will, aber ja, keine Ahnung. Auch ein faszinierendes Thema. Und wir bekommen dann quasi sein zweites Reading druckfrisch zu hören am 17. Februar 2017, same time, same station. Ich bedanke mich bei allen fürs Zuhören und fürs Interesse. Wir hören uns wieder am 17. Februar 2017. Bis dorthin, danke fürs Zuhören und macht es gut. So the thrill of it.
Whoa.